It's time for the Sandler Training Hour on News Talk 670 KBOI. Here's your host, Jim Stevens.
Welcome to the weekend. Each week I invite keynote Sandler trainers to discuss strategies required to improve attitude, behavior, and techniques using the proven and highly successful Sandler training system. This week my guest is Ken Guest. Ken is from Akron, Ohio, and I've asked Ken to be on the program because he did a talk at one of our recent conventions where he covered the science behind finding, courting, and then closing large accounts. Ken, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Jim. I appreciate the time.
I'm delighted to have you, Ken. So kick us off. How do you define and then identify what a large client is?
Well, I think it's a moving target with elephant hunting. I use that as the title of my talk, but really elephant hunting is any type of account that in your specific world as a salesperson accounts for a lot of money. It could be a lot of business, a lot of repeat business. It could be large Fortune 500 companies, but it certainly doesn't have to be.
It's really a dollar amount that makes a significant difference in your year. It's almost as though you think about the amount of time it takes to identify and close a small to mid-size account, it may not take a lot more time to close those elephants. Fair?
Yeah, absolutely. It does not necessarily take more time. It's just a more scientific approach, in my opinion, really helps make that easier.
So talk us through the science behind this. Where do I start? I think most people who are in business development or sales or even small business owners, we kind of stumble into those big opportunities. We're grateful when we have them, but recreating it might be a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, so I have really four parts to this whole process. And the part one that I think is the most important part is we really need to have a very scientific approach on identifying what an elephant is. And really, it's any type of ideal account. If you've ever seen some of the Sandler Enterprise selling stuff, one of the most powerful tools they have is the CARE tool, which is an acronym for basically an account classification system. And I look at it like that. That process that you go through in the enterprise selling is to identify what are all the components that make up our best type of account, the type of account we should be pursuing. It could be a combination of subjective things, like they're easy to do business with, they allow me to make a mistake every now and then without ending the relationship. And it could be objective things like annual revenue they generate or annual profits they generate or they pay their bills on time, those types of things. So for me, when I first started looking into how to identify an elephant in my world as a sales trainer, I looked at my colleagues here in Akron, Ohio, who had been doing it longer than me. And I said, what are those four, five, six common denominators, common threads that make up the mix of our best accounts? And so I would challenge anybody in sales, you should take your top 5, 10, 15, 20 accounts and say, what are the commonalities that they have? Because we all know they have them. It could be revenue size of the company. It could be number of employees in the company. It could be any number of things. And once you identify that, now you would know who is my ideal target client. So that's really my first step, is you got to go through the research process of who you've worked with before, what are your best relationships, and what are those common themes. I promise you there will be some there.
Are you recommending, Ken, that we take the time to do an interview of our clients to find out why they work with us, what they find the benefit is, so that we can find those commonalities? What's the best mechanical way to achieve this?
Well, I think there's two things. I think your suggestion is great. I think that is one thing, is to identify by asking your clients, why do they like working with you? You know, when I teach certain workshops and people are trying to set up what their 30-second commercial sounds like, one of the challenges I ask them is I say, if I were to call your top 10 or 20 clients, why would they tell me they keep working with you? What are those reasons? And hopefully there are some that they can easily identify. And once you identify those through talking to your clients, you also have internal research you can do just by how much they spend with you every year, what the profit margin is. If you're selling, in particular, if you're selling in manufacturing with widgets or something, you're going to know that margin. But it could be any number of things. But I really think you do an analysis of who are your best customers and then try to figure out what are those common themes.
One of the things that we've been taught over and over in sales is you always have to call on the top of the organization. I found with some of these larger deals that may not be exactly accurate, that sometimes you need to find the person who is most likely to help you open the door to make that transaction happen. Give us your thoughts on that.
Well, actually, you're moving right into step two of my process, which is, you know, once you identify those companies, how do you get in front of them? And you're exactly right. I use a process through LinkedIn and through social media that I'm finding out, how do I get an introduction into those people? Because the larger key account account businesses, your chances of getting in there through a cold call are slim and none. If you were to get in there with a cold call, you certainly, it's not a warm introduction. It's a lot more difficult process.
Right.
And my opinion is there's a lot of fish in the sea that you could get a warm introduction for. So why spend a lot of time and energy focusing on the cold ones that you really have no way to get in front of? So one of the things, to your point, is take the time to go into LinkedIn to look at who are some common connections that we might be able to leverage to get an introduction into the right person. I am a big believer in, whenever possible, calling on the top of the organization, but certainly they can refer you down into the other folks. Mm-hmm. But if you have no way of getting in front of them, you're much better off trying to get a warm introduction into somebody in a decision-making capacity.
One of the tools that LinkedIn and other digital resources provide for those of us in business development is really getting our head around the multiple advisors and or decision makers, influencers in the decision process, and then sending our message to them so that in an ideal world, you've got the CEO, the CFO, the purchasing training director, HR, whoever it is that you're talking about, is all hearing this dripping of your name so that when it comes up, there's a familiarity. Give us some of your strategies around that.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head with dripping on people. One of the things that I do, which is even more personalized, is I've taken everybody that I've trained over the last 6 or 7 years as a trainer, which is quite a few different people, and I've made a point to actually write personal testimonials for their profile. So what I would do is I'd go into that recommendation section of LinkedIn, write a personal testimonial. It can tend to be a bit self-serving because I'm going to tell them the growth that I saw in them once they came to Sandler training, but it's real. It's the truth.
Yes.
And once I send it to them, invariably, you know, they want to write one back for me. So there's almost that, to use the old Sandler term, this is more of a modern day version of what David Sandler used to call the fuzzy file.
Right.
It's just a touch point. It's a way to stay in front of them. And they're so appreciative when you do it. And the bulk of them reciprocate. So then we all in business, I think, struggle with asking our clients for written testimonials. This is a modern day version to get one of those reciprocated that you can use on your website, put out the social media then. And again, more touch points because I'm putting those testimonials out for these prospects to potentially see. So once I've done that, then it's even easier for me to then go into their profile and ask, you know, who they know that might make sense for me to get in front of. They're more than happy to do that. Couple that with another point that you made about touch points. There's endorsements you can do on LinkedIn. There's even wishing them a happy birthday or a work anniversary or all of those different kinds of things. And the magic to that, whether it's any of these social media outlets, is they're going to get an email saying that you've done that for them. And again, the email is the touch point. There's that guy again. He's in front of me.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So there's just multiple ways in today's digital society that you can do these touch points that are really effective.
We're heading into a break here, Ken. Give us a teaser. What's the next point we're going to talk about in elephant hunting?
Well, I think the next point and where I would spend a lot of my time is the areas of the Sandler submarine that I think are extremely important to focus on, and the areas that maybe sometimes you can get away with a little bit that without having to be so thorough in your using the selling process.
Awesome. My guest today is Ken Guest. Ken, give your contact information in case somebody would like to reach out to you.
Yeah, my email address is ken.guest@sandler.com. My last name is Guest, and my phone number is 330-421-7347.
And I'm Idaho's Sandler trainer, Jim Stevens. Visit our website at www.crossroads.sandler.com and download the 3 biggest mistakes salespeople should never make. For specific questions or comments, call us at 208-429-9275. This is Sandler Training, finding power in reinforcement. As a business owner or manager, do you have that gnawing feeling in your gut that says something's just not right? It's not uncommon to be so immersed in the daily battle that you're unaware of the small changes you could make that would produce a significant return on investment. I'm Jim Stevens with Sandler Training. We are a training and consulting firm who specialize in helping businesses increase gross and net profit, cash flow, and referrals generated from stellar customer service. Listen to my friend and client, Brandon Wright, the owner of UltraClean, share his experience with Sandler Training.
I did $1.7 million when I met you, had 26 employees, and after my coaching with you, we grew another million with 16 employees, so 10 less employees, we did another million. So what does that tell you? It means I was doing something wrong.
If you're courageous enough to face what you may not know that could hurt you, give me a call. call Jim Stevens, 208-429-9275. That's 208-429-9275. Crossroads.sandler.com. And welcome to one of my favorite segments of this program, which is Entrepreneur Radio. In this case, we're going to call it Intrapreneur Radio. I have with me my guest today is Glenn Scott. Glenn is the Vice President of HR for Impact Group. Is that right, Glenn?
That's correct.
So introduce yourself. Tell the folks who you are and what you do.
Well, as you said, I'm the Vice President of Human Resources for Impact Group. We're a food brokerage company for manufacturers, representing them with retail outlets throughout the country.
And your home office is right here in Boise.
Corporate office here in Boise. We do have about 12 offices throughout the country, but home offices here. Yeah.
And the Impact Group has been growing by leaps and bounds. Tell us a little bit about the growth you've been experiencing.
Since about last April, we went through a pretty significant acquisition last April where we melded essentially about three companies together.
Wow.
Kind of in one shot on one day.
Oh my gosh.
And
glutton for punishment.
Yeah. And since then, we've done another two, working on a third. So it'd be six kind of total acquisitions.
Wow.
And so we've gone from a year ago, April, we had about 125 employees to 575.
Wow.
So some pretty significant
growth. Boy, that's a lot of change to try to manage.
Yes, it is.
And every human who's involved has their own emotions,
right?
Behind the move.
Exactly.
Wow. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that. Give the listeners a little bit of your personal background. You do adjunct professor at BSU,
right?
That type of thing.
So I have since about 2012, 2013, somewhere in there, been an adjunct within the Organizational Performance Workplace Learning Department at Boise State. It's a graduate program.
Cool.
For people interested in organizational performance growth, individual development training. And before Impact, I was with the company MyBullfrog.com for about 6 years, kind of doing the same thing I'm doing here.
Oh, really?
So,
okay,
yeah.
Great. So let's talk a little bit about some of the challenges. Businesses like to grow through acquisition because it helps you expand your balance sheet and P&L statement very quickly.
Right.
But it also brings with it a lot of headaches, I can imagine. So share with our listeners, what are some of the challenges that are inherent in managing a merger like that?
Yeah, I think that there's a number of them, but I think it really occurs on a couple of different levels. One is on your executive leadership level, and of course the other is kind of on the ground floor level. Really starting with the executive leadership level, you know, one of the things that occurs when you make a decision that you're going to grow and you're going to go through some significant growth through acquisition, you've made a decision that that's your strategic direction for growth.
Mm-hmm.
It requires you to grow a little differently than you did before, that organically you have the ability to add a person here, add a person there.
Right.
Through acquisition, you really need to be ahead of the curve in being prepared to bring on a significant number of people all at once.
Mm-hmm.
As you do the acquisition. And really it requires you to bring on a different talent set at your executive level in a lot of ways.
Right.
A group to manage a larger organization. And so you, generally speaking, there's been a lot of growth,
mm-hmm.
but it's been organic and it's been slow over time. And you have some pretty key people in executive positions that have brought you to where you are.
And they know their job and they're doing it consistently.
And usually they've got multiple hats,
right,
that they're wearing.
Right.
Now you got to bring on different people that maybe they're going to take one of the hats away,
right,
from one of your key people. And sometimes all of the hats,
right,
but certainly some of them. And people who have created an identity in that are going to have a hard time giving that out.
Right.
And so people's scope changes, their scope of responsibility, their scope of authority changes. And that's not easy for people to make that change. And sometimes you discover that it's, even though it's the person that brought you where you are, it's not necessarily the person that's going to be able to get you where you need to go.
Right.
And those are tough decisions.
I bet they are, and tough conversations.
Yeah. And then the other piece of that is you're bringing in people from outside who don't have the organizational history that maybe someone that's been with you for the last 15 years does. And so they're going to bring different ideas, different ways of doing things. So you're going to have some challenges within your executive group as you grow it.
And it seems to me that the challenges are maybe company-wide, but also individual. Each person is going through their own drama of change that they may have been a part of or maybe not. They may be a hostage to it. How do you manage that emotional powder keg that must be there?
Well, if you figure that out, can you let me know? Just like it's every one of them deals with it with change differently, every situation is a little bit different. And you've got to figure out, sometimes sometimes you have to help them pull back the layers and help them see how the change benefits them long term.
So you may be the vice president of HR, but you're really a psychologist.
Without the training.
Without the training. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, sometimes I need my own probably. So
I bet that's true. In a merger and acquisition, is it typically pre-anticipated who's going to be let go? Or do you bring them in and then you start the weeding? Because obviously we bought a company because we have some dual allocation of resources. We can do all of our billing here so we can eliminate.
Right. You know, we try as much as we can to identify those up front.
Yeah.
And know going in, you know, usually that's part of the value set that you're trying to build mm-hmm. forward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in our particular situation, we haven't had a lot of that, mostly because the acquisitions we've been doing have been in large part to expand footprint and expand representation with certain retailers.
So you've needed everybody.
So we've needed most everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
There's certainly, and interestingly enough, we see some synergies in particular areas where we have a couple that maybe we make that tough decision with, we need to add somewhere else. And so, you know, when we look at a pretty significant acquisition that we did at the beginning of the year, when you look at the number of people in totality, we actually have more, not less.
Mm.
And so you definitely want to account for those up front. I mean, generally you can see pretty quickly where you're going to have the synergies. And the longer you draw that process out, the more difficult it becomes because people become nervous because 6 months later you're still making synergetic changes.
And productivity is tanking and
right.
People wonder, GMI next, then
right.
That can't be good.
So the sooner you can make those decisions and have those conversations, the better it is for everybody.
And is it typical that a lot of this type of, I don't know, coaching almost that you're doing, it comes to HR?
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the most part, yeah. Yeah.
Let Glenn handle it.
Yeah.
Hey, I've got something for Glenn to do.
Yeah, a lot of times they come that way. And so, you know, it's interesting because one of the things that I've seen is a lot of times that even the people that maybe are reductions are occurring because of synergies, mostly, again, the reason to discover those early and have those conversations early is even for the people who the decision may not be the best for them, they would rather know
right.
than not know.
Right.
And so the sooner that you can say, hey, this is what is happening, this is what it's going to look like. You know, I've seen situations where all of a sudden, if they know they're leaving in a couple of months, you know, and there's a transition, their productivity actually increases just because at least they know.
At least they know.
It's hard to live in a world where you don't know what's happening to you.
Yeah, and most employees are employees because they want stability.
Right.
They chose not to be an entrepreneur.
Right.
Because they don't want the risk. And now if you're not, I have the risk, but you don't tell me I have the risk, my whole life can be in a turmoil and it's hard to sleep.
You know, it's interesting. In fact, as you talk about that, I just read the other day an interesting thing relating to change. And, you know, we talk a lot about people fear change, and actually came from adaptive leadership. The author said they don't actually fear change, they fear loss. And change usually indicates loss for them.
Yeah.
And especially when you're talking about organizational change, when you're talking about acquisitions, those type of things, even when you're talking about growth, there's, as we mentioned, with the loss of scope of responsibility, there's
right.
fear of loss.
Yeah.
And that's what they fear more than just change.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of things that can change in our lives that we can be pretty excited about.
And I think people generally are resilient. I know in my role as a consultant, I've helped a couple of organizations that were downsizing and literally closing plants. And the thing that made it not only palatable, but in some cases almost an adventure for the employees was the company cared enough to help create a career path, and they had interview opportunities, and they really worked hard. We were hired to help train people to be good at an interview so that they could land that new job.
Right, absolutely. Providing people negative news or news that isn't going to be positive for them is never fun.
Right.
But when you can help them see the path forward
right.
and you can be involved in that with them, then you can really change something that could be very difficult into something positive.
Last subject I'd like to tackle is just understanding how do you handle that cultural transition? Because I know in a lot of the companies I work with, they'll give me their core values and they look really good. And then I go into the company and I'm interviewing people and I'm saying, so share with me of your core values, what's the most important? They can't even tell me what they are. And the deeper you get into the organization, the more you realize that the core values are not what they seem to be. What they say they value and the politics they've created created are a day and night difference. So how do you blend all that in a merger like this?
Well, it's always interesting, I think, when a lot of times the perception from the executive group in terms of what the culture is and the perception from the people who live in it every day can be significantly different.
Yeah.
And when you have an executive team that isn't afraid of knowing what's really going on out there and can take the tough stuff and can be open about that, then a lot of times that chasm, that gap, you can shrink in terms of what's being experienced versus what you
think you hope to.
You know, this is our core values. Oh, really? Because that's not what I
that's not what we're seeing.
Yeah. And so I think that when you're talking about merging them in an acquisition, then more than anything, it's important to blend those groups and help them start to see the positive things that both sides bring to the table. And that starts with the executive team, right? You have to bring them together and you have to have those open conversations about what are we trying to be? What are our values? How do you understand those different than I do so that you can be on the same page? And it starts there. And then you need to start doing that with lower levels of the organization as well, because the more they see each other, the more that they work with each other, the more they're going to be able to blend those together. And if you don't do that, then they continue to operate as two separate entities.
Plus, you have to hold up the mirror and say, let's be honest about ourselves,
because
we're not always as good as we think we are.
Right.
I know I'm a legend in my own mind. So, Glenn, give some advice. If we have a listener out there who is a business owner, manager, they're thinking about wanting to sell their business, what advice would you give them in preparing for a merger or an acquisition?
I think that for somebody who is looking at whether it be an exit plan or something like that, number one, trying to find an organization that really truly does represents to the best of its ability. I mean, there's always, like I say, going to be nuances that are different, but represents what you've tried to build so that you're putting your people in the best possible situation. So, you know, it really starts there. You really need to identify what you want that to look like. And then, so you need to be diligent about that, not selling to just anybody. But
do you think you should keep the news on the down low from employees? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think every situation with that is different. You need to bring your key people in, obviously, as early as you feel comfortable. You know, the thing is, when you are talking about, if you're an entrepreneur out there and you've built a company, when you're talking about selling it, it's going to create a nervous feel for it for the people who know. And so that's always a tough question. And keeping everybody in the dark all the way through also doesn't work. There's some people that are not going to feel that you trust or that feel like you've trusted, that keeping them in the dark all the way through will break down that trust.
Yeah, they'll feel betrayed.
Right. And so once you reach the point where you're pretty serious about what you're doing, then you need to bring your key people in and say, hey, this is what's going on. This is how. And more than anything, you need to help them see how they potentially benefit from it.
Yeah.
Because you're going to need their help in making the making the process smooth.
See that it is a change, not a loss.
Right, right.
Awesome. Well, Glenn Scott has been my guest today. Glenn is the vice president of the HR department at Impact Group. Glenn, give your contact information in case somebody be interested in having an extended conversation with you.
Yeah, if you're interested in talking further about it, any of this, or my email address is gd.scott@gmail.com and phone number 208-871-3157.
Awesome. You've been a great guest today. Listeners, if you'd like to be on the program, please reach out to me at 208-429-9275, or perhaps you know somebody who has a treasure trove like Glenn of knowledge and expertise that would be interesting content for our program. My email, you can get us at crossroads@sandler.com. If you don't feel qualified to be on the show and would like help getting there, you might call us 208-429-9275. Sandler Training, we help businesses develop their management team, sales structure, systems, and processes so that they can achieve excellence in their industry. We're going to be back just after this. Hi, this is Jim Stevens with Sandler Training. With the baby boomer generation maturing, 8 million businesses will be sold or closed in the next 10 years. 75% of those companies have business owners who want to sell their business, but only 20% of them will be successful. If you're a business owner who's thinking about selling or transitioning your firm to your employees, and you're not sure if you'll be able to achieve your dream of a successful transition, call me, Jim Stevens, 208-429-9275. I will help you determine what actions will be required to position your business for a successful transition. Our initial no-cost analysis will help you see the four steps required to achieve success. Sandler Training, 208-429-9275. That's 208-429-9275. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, we're ready to help. Sandler Training, 208-429-9275. So far, I've been talking with Sandler trainer Ken Gass, and now we're going to ask him to take us into a little more detail and walk us through some of the steps involved in elephant hunting. How do I find, identify, and then close those major accounts? Ken, take it away.
So we've talked previously in the last segment about how to get in front of them and ask for those introductions to get in front of the right people. Once you get that introduction and you get in front of those right people, there are certain compartments of the Sandler submarine that I think are even more important with elephant hunting in certain compartments that maybe you can get away with a little bit not being as thorough or detailed when you're in front of those types of accounts. The one out of the gates that is incredibly important, in my opinion, particularly if I'm in front of a decision maker, which in most cases when I'm pursuing elephants, I don't go on meetings unless I'm in front of somebody that at least is partially capable of being a decision maker. But the one compartment right out of the gates that's incredibly important is bonding and rapport. Mm. And I heard another Sandler trainer say this one time, and I thoroughly agree with this, that all the principles of psychology that we teach in bonding and rapport really come down to one overriding rule or goal of that compartment, and that is to gain and then maintain that equal business stature. So we're using all of those different techniques that we teach, like understanding people's disc profile and all these other things, to gain and maintain equal business stature. When you're in front of elephants, I believe that in the first 5 minutes of the meeting, they're sizing you up. Your personal presence is incredibly important. You have to act like you've been there before. You have to act like you're not intimidated by being in front of those people, even if it's typically a position higher than you're used to calling on with your other accounts. And so your personal presence, the way you communicate with them, identifying their disc profile and matching and mirroring is very important. I'll take it a step further. I do sales training for a $2 billion company in the transportation industry, and I got introduced for a first meeting to the CEO of that company, who obviously was the decision maker, 10,000 employees in the business. I was so focused on matching and mirroring and bonding and rapport with this gentleman that I even called the front desk before I came into the building. And I said, can I ask you a really dumb question to the receptionist? And she said, what? And I said, what does he typically wear? Being in the trucking industry, I didn't know if it was jeans or a suit.
Right.
And so I asked and she laughed and she said, why do you want to know that? And I said, the last thing I want to do is come in there with a three-piece suit on it and you guys are all in jeans. And she laughed. She said, I'd be glad to tell you. She said, he always wears a button-down dress shirt and a sport coat with no tie. So certainly I went in matching and mirroring, which is very important, and it served me well. And in the first 5 minutes of that meeting, it was clear that he was sizing me up, and we instantly bonded. So I think the various principles that we teach in bonding and rapport are incredibly important when people are sizing you up in those first 5 minutes.
And I think one of the things in the Sandler process that then catalyzes that is the upfront contract, where you're actually stepping in, taking a degree of intentional leadership over the sales call, even though you're in front of somebody who's used to calling the shots. Talk to us about that.
Yes, upfront contract definitely was the next thing that's incredibly important. I will say this, I'll talk to you about the five elements and the things that I think are vitally important, and then the things I think I tend to maybe get away with not being as thorough with my following of that process. But outcomes is clearly the first thing you have to talk about. I don't subscribe to the theory that there's a given order to those five elements. I think you get the one out that you're most nervous about talking about first. And so talking about and giving somebody very quickly the permission to say no, if this is not a fit right out of the gates, is vitally important. And so I would always talk about that first, particularly if I'm introduced through a mutual friend, which in the trucking company example was certainly the case. And I went in and I said, just because he thought it was a good idea for us to talk doesn't mean that you think it's a good idea. And at the end of this may not make any sense. So please feel free to tell me that if that's the case. What I have found is understanding disc profiles. A lot of CEOs are D's on the disc, so they are quick decision makers. And I always believe that the D's probably love the upfront contract philosophy as much as any personality style, because they are get to the point kind of people.
Right. Yeah, I think that's awesome. It's very typical. You use the term sizing up. I think that's really what the beginning steps of every relationship is. We say in Sandler, if you're going to dance, lead, and we call it the buyer-seller dance. And there is this little dance dance that happens where we're trying to figure out, are we going to be a good fit? And if not, can we get to clear no instead of dancing around some think it over that drags the pipeline? So giving them the authority and responsibility of making that decision is very empowering, I think.
Absolutely. I think the other thing that I do, which is part of a sizing up process that I would recommend for anyone, I know Sandler says when you go into the upfront contract, you always reconfirm the time that you have for the meeting and you confirm how much time you're going to have for the meeting. I think a mistake I see with salespeople out there is somebody like this type of CEO of an elephant might say, I'll give you 20 minutes of my time. And that's just not a quality use of time. 20 minutes, nobody's going to make a decision. So what I do is I go in expecting 60 to 90 minutes for any meeting. And quite honestly, I don't typically talk about time on the initial phone call or email exchange. I just send them a calendar invite expecting 60 to 90 minutes for a meeting. In 6 years of doing that, I've only had one person actually call my office and tell me that the time that I sent them on the calendar invite was not right. And it was actually the trucking company CEO who said, if we're going to have any meaningful discussion about training some of my 10,000 employees, we cannot do it in 60 minutes. We're going to need 90 to 2 hours.
Wow.
And I've not had anybody push back on that, but it's an expectation. Yeah. I think it's a mindset of going in expecting, look, we're going to have a meaningful business discussion, which at the end we might decide this doesn't make sense and that's fine, but we're certainly not going to do it in 15 minutes.
Right. Yeah, I think taking that control and ownership over the time allows you to really establish that equal business stature. I tell people when I'm booking the appointment, look, we're probably going to need 2 hours. However, let's book 2 hours. And in the first 60 minutes, if we think it's worth continuing, we'll keep going. Otherwise, we both get an hour back in our day. Almost never get. In fact, I think I've never had any pushback on that also, now that you mention it.
Yeah, I love that. My colleague here in Akron, Ohio, he once went on a sales call with a vice president of sales of a company that had 20 salespeople. And he told the vice president of sales that I'm probably going to need 60 minutes, but would you mind if I figure out that we're not a fit before you do, which usually I can figure it out first. Are you going to be offended if I raise my hand and end the meeting 15 minutes early? And she signed the sales training contract that day because she said the minute that he told her that, she knew that he was the guy to train her people.
That's a great strip line. I'm going to use that. That's awesome. So, Ken, we've talked about the upfront contract, which part of it is designed to help us get a pain-based agenda. So how do you transition into that pain step?
So typically, you know, part of the other elements of the upfront contract are the various agendas, and I settle those through an email exchange typically about the topics that they want to talk about. I'm a big believer in sending homework out to all prospects, and this can be done really in any industry, and it really is a series. It's a little one-page document with 40 or 50 potential pain bullet points of challenges they could be facing in their world. And we've actually coached our clients on how to develop their own as well, and every time we send those out, we get a high percentage of those returned. We'll ask them to take 3 or 4 minutes, check the boxes that apply. Out of the 40 or 50, I've seen them check as little as 2 or 3, and I actually had one woman pick the phone up and call me when she got the document and said, really, it's the whole page.
Wow.
And so we're settling the pain agendas before we ever get there by them completing that and sending it back to me. Now I know not only the things that I want to focus on, but I also know the things that I don't want to talk about. And so that kind of really tees up this pain discussion once we get into the face-to-face.
My guest today is Ken Guest. Ken, give your contact information in case somebody'd like to reach out to you.
Sure. It's ken.guest, G-U-E-S-T, at sandler.com, or my number is 330-421-7347.
And I'm Idaho's CEO of Sandler Training, Jim Stevens. If you like this show and want to subscribe to our content, email us at crossroads@sandler.com. That's crossroads@sandler.com. Or reach out and ask us how to subscribe by calling 208-429-9275. This is Sandler Training, finding power in reinforcement. This is Jim Stevens with Sandler Training. Insanity is doing the same thing the same way, expecting different results. Change is difficult and messy. As a result, most people push themselves to work harder because they don't realize there's an alternative. Sheer willpower and determination can only go so far in making a significant impact. Charisma or optimism alone is not enough to capture your ideal client at a price point that allows you to grow your business. Loyalty to employees and clients sustains a devoted following, but will not attract the talent or clients needed to help more people benefit from your services. Accurate systems and processes are vital. However, this alone is not going to achieve your desired results. Most business owners don't have the courage necessary to challenge their comfort zone. If you are the exception and are ready to roll up your sleeves, get messy, and change, call me at Sandler Training, 208-429-9275. That's 208-429-9275. Or connect on the web at crossroads.sandler.com. Ken, so far we've talked about the conceptual, but I'd like us to get into some of the technical. I don't suppose you'd be willing to walk us through some of the specific applications of finding pain. We've talked about getting that upfront contract so that we're now in the pain discussion. What does it sound like?
So what it sounds like is typically if I get that homework back that we talked about in the last segment where they've indicated to me maybe their top three or four pain points, I'm a big believer in third-party stories. And I, like most salespeople, grew up selling features and benefits, and sometimes we as salespeople get really excited about wanting to share those features and benefits. There is a way that you can do that that resonates very powerfully, particularly with the elephant type accounts. And how I do that is sharing a third-party story. We have a rule here that we talk about all the time to our clients in Ohio, is that you never, ever, ever tell somebody what you can do for them to a prospect. You only tell them how you helped other companies, and they will psychologically compartmentalize that information and make it their own. So when I'm in front of people, if I get those pain points back, I have a series of third-party stories that are scripted in my head that I will repeat over and over and over again. So if somebody tells me they're struggling with prospecting, I'm going to use a story about a company that I trained that told me the same thing, and then what we were able to do with them as a result. So let's say we had somebody, we have clients all the time that tell us, you know, my salespeople have tons of opportunities in the quote pipeline that they've quoted. We have no idea what the status of those are, and we don't know if they're coming in or not. And I'll say, you know, that's funny. I don't know if this would help your company, but when I worked with ABC Company, and by the way, I'm a huge believer in name dropping. So if you are working with another elephant, by all means, share that name if you're allowed to. But I will say, when I worked with ABC Company, I went into a sales meeting 1 month, and they told me they had 250 open proposals on their report. And I said, what are the average number of times that you follow up with those proposals just to see if you're going to get them? And they shared with me their average number was 5. So you may say that's a lot or a little, but I said, now tell me, you typically spend 3 to 5 minutes, I would say, either calling and leaving that voicemail or typing out and sending that email to follow up. So no wonder you don't really have a lot of time to prospect, because you're spending all your time following up. So I was able to teach them a method to empty out the bad of their pipeline through a scripted email that we sent out. And I went back in the next month, and instead of 250, they had 37. The other thing they learned was that 37 was real opportunities that they were still in the game, but the other 213, they actually gave the client permission to say no. So that would be an example of a story. Nice. That's a real life story.
Nice.
That I shared, and it always resonates with people that are struggling with that kind of thing, because the next thing they want to know is, how can you do that for me?
So when you're covering the topic of finding a compelling reason someone would have to use your services, that is generally just telling stories, or you're also asking questions to help uncover some of their personal impact?
Well, you're certainly asking questions. So if I were to get that homework back and they said my people aren't prospecting enough, the first thing I'm going to do is ask some questions to dig a little bit deeper about what that really means. What do they mean behind that?
Mm-hmm.
So once they share that and I find the right time to bring in a story, the other thing, if you noticed, is I incorporated a reverse out of the gates, a negative reverse, saying maybe this doesn't mean anything to you, or this doesn't resonate with you. So you always want to throw that in there as part of your story, so they're not feeling pressure to say that they want to do the same thing that you were doing with somebody else.
Right. That's a great point. So finding pain is all about understanding what is their compelling reason, what's the problem behind it, what's the personal impact. Shifting gears, now in the Sandler sequence of things, there's next is budget and decision. Are those important steps when you're doing elephant hunting, Ken?
So my opinion on both of those steps is two things. Typically, I do not do a very thorough budget step, because my belief is if you're in front of an elephant, if there's pain, they will find the money. It's your job to create enough pain. If you don't create the pain, then budget becomes an issue. But every time I've been in front of an elephant that had plenty of pain, they figured out how to find the money. So I don't spend a ton of time on it. The other thing is on the decision-making process step, the biggest of the interrogatives that you're looking to get answers to me, is the who. Am I in front of the right person? And 9 times out of 10, when I'm elephant hunting, I'm in front of the right person. And so I don't spend a lot of time saying who besides yourself is involved in making a decision like this when I'm talking to the CEO, because I think it's almost offensive to him. Now, the other thing of the interrogatives that is important is, when would you like to get started and when do you want to make a decision? So I feel there's two whens that are important to know, and that's whether, no matter what industry you're in, if you're in manufacturing, a lot of times there's a startup time frame to get moving forward with a new product line or to make a switch from an incumbent. So I think the whens are the most important thing to find out to see if you can meet that given deadline or not.
And at that point, are you literally building a timeline of benchmarks or road markers?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's a new tool actually in our new Sandler tools that is a decision timeline creator, which I think is a fabulous tool. And I think it really brings some perspective to certain industries that have that long ramp up period. They can then clearly communicate that with their client. Should you want to move forward with us, you know, this is the amount of time we're going to need for setup. This is the amount of time we're going to need in the credit department and all those different hoops that we have to jump through.
And is that a specific sheet of paper you're handing them to ask them to look at, or is it just a conversation?
Just a conversation. Typically in our world, we're calling on all different industries, so it might be a little more regimented depending on the industry that I'm calling on, but in most cases, it's just a conversation.
I do a lot of whiteboard selling, and I find that actually drawing out that timeline, even if you're on just a sheet of paper, one of the things I like to understand is, what have you done from today? I'm guessing this isn't the first time you've thought about doing XYZ. Would you mind sharing with me prior to today some of the attempts you've made at helping resolve these problems so I can get a context of their timeline?
I think that's fantastic. And the other thing, by doing it on the whiteboard or on a sheet of paper, is certainly the visuals that you're meeting with can really, it resonates with them much, much greater when they see it as opposed to just talking about it. So I think that's a great point.
So we're at the point of really closing the sale. What does that sound like when I'm elephant hunting?
I think the biggest thing with closing the sale, it was a lesson learned for me when I started getting in front of more elephants. If you act wishy-washy or flexible in your fulfillment step or presentation step approach, you lose credibility. I think when I'm in front of those, the minute that I started having a more regimented process, and I'll share another third-party story with you. I was calling on the CEO of a $500 million construction company, and we were having a conversation, and I brought my process out. We were at that fulfillment step in terms of how would we potentially work together, and I brought my process out on a document, and I said, here's how I typically work with companies. And as I started to go through it, he stopped me in the first 3 minutes, and he said, well, you know, we're going to have to customize this and do it so it's more like our way. And I said, that's fine, but with all due respect, I've done this 1,000 times. Would you mind letting me walk through the entire process of why I do it the way I do it when I engage with companies?
Nice.
And then at the end, be glad to talk to you about any potential changes that you might want to make. We got to the end of the discussion, and he said, sounds like you've been here before. You've done this a lot. I wouldn't change a thing.
That's awesome. And there again, you're showing your equal business stature by challenging him. And that's somebody who has spent most of his life having people agree with him, surrounded by yes people, instead of somebody who says, with all due respect. Great, great point.
Yes, absolutely.
So, Ken, give your contact information in case somebody would like to reach out to you.
Sure. It's ken.guest, G-U-E-S-T, at sandler.com. And my phone number is 330-421-7347.
This is Jim Stevens with Sandler Training. My calling is to wake people up from the slumber of mediocrity. Are you tired of forgiving your employees for not trying? Are you bored with the daily rituals of at least and just enough that you allow to haunt you all weekend? Are you ready to test yourself and see if you can do it? Are you ready to test your team? Call us at 208-429-9275. Ask to set up a discovery meeting. We'll set up a conversation. This is Sandler Training, finding power in reinforcement. Have you noticed that you can smell a salesperson a mile away? It's the smell of neediness and desperation. This is Jim Stevens with Sandler Training. Listen to my client, Bethany Bredegar, with Sonatrol Pacific, share her experience learning how to stop selling and become a trusted advisor.
Everything you teach is centered around not doing what the customer expects, that dance that you do back and forth that I was stuck doing and didn't like my job when I was having to do that. And changed my actual job description and the way that I interact with clients. clients, so much so that now I feel very proud of what I do, and I love going to work, and I don't feel like I'm getting caught in that dance anymore. I'm able to actually talk to people, and they forget I'm a salesperson because of these techniques. They end up selling it themselves, and I feel like I'm not even selling.
Stop the buyer-seller dance and learn to love your career again. Call me. Jim Stevens, 208-429-9275. That's 208-429-9275, or on the web at crossroads.sandler.com.
Everything you teach is centered around not doing what the customer expects. That dance that you do back and forth that I was stuck doing and didn't like my job when I was having to do that. And it changed my actual job description and the way that I interact with clients so much so that now I feel very proud of what I do, and I love going to work, and I don't feel like I'm getting caught in that dance anymore. I'm able to actually talk to people, and they forget I'm a salesperson because of these techniques. They end up selling it themselves, and I feel like I'm not even selling.
Sandler Training develops a plan to make sure your team has the skills they need to close the sale. Learn more online at crossroads.sandler.com.
Welcome back to the Sandler Training Hour. I'm with Sandler trainer Ken Guest. Now, Ken, Sandler is really a trial of ongoing reinforcement and commitment for us. I'd like you to walk us through some of the frustrations, concerns, and challenges that you've developed in your life, and what kind of things are you working through now to help take your game to the next level?
Well, I think like everybody, we evaluate our sales and our business, and this past year I got to a bit of a plateau in my own performance, and I'm happy where I'm at, but I always want to be striving to get to that next level. And I actually reached out to some fellow Sandler trainers who are very successful, and I asked them for some suggestions, advice, coaching, whatever you want to call it, as to what they think I'm doing well, what I think I need to be doing a lot better. And interesting response was, number one, do I know my formula for success, my metrics all the way through? Do I know my dials to conversation rate? Do I know my conversation to first meeting rate, a success rate? And not knowing that, you really would have no way of knowing how to get to that next level or what it would take behaviorally to get to that level. Fortunately, I have been tracking that, but I've made a conscious effort to track that at a much higher level of detail than I ever have before. Out of that formula, I set goals for myself for 2017 that were dramatically higher than what I've done previously, and I realized that the level of prospecting that I had to do to hit the number based on my success rate was literally 2.5 times the level of prospecting I did last year.
Wow.
And so I went to my wife in January and I said, honey, I want to hit this number, but in order to do that, I'm going to have to do a whole lot more prospecting than I've ever done before. I don't know where the hours in the day are going to come from, but I'm going to commit for the month of January that even if I have to work 80 or 90 hours, I'm going to hit that level of prospecting activity, and let's just see what happens. We get to the end of January. If it's too much, maybe we adjust the goals, whatever. And what I found was I still basically worked the same workday that I was working before.
Huh.
And wow. In all transparency and frustration, I said to myself, what was I doing last year?
Where did I find that time? I thought I was way too busy.
Yeah, but it's interesting how when we develop a goal and we're committed to a goal, that suddenly we get more efficient and more focused. What I have found is blocking time off on the calendar to prospect. I will say this, every client we work with, it's the same thing. The number one issue, and you probably see this too, Jim, is they don't do enough prospecting. Yeah. And so they have to find the time to do the prospecting. These Sandler trainers that I got some coaching from, they also looked at the numbers that I had done in previous years in terms of level of behaviors. And they said, that's really not that much, Ken. You really should do a whole lot more. In this business, like any other business, you need a lot of at-bats, to use the baseball analogy. You just need to get a lot of at-bats. So I've really focused on all year doing this tremendously higher level of prospecting. And I had a client tell me once that sales is a simple math problem. He's a very knowledgeable guy. He's been through Sandler for years and CEO of a very large company. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, you do the dials to have the conversations, to get the meetings, to close the business. And he said, it really is simple math. And it's amazing how I've done this level of behaviors now for 7 consecutive months this year, and the level of sales has dramatically went up. And so my suggestion is the same lesson that I learned myself. Figure out what your math problem is. Do a whole lot more prospecting, and the results will come out of the back end. Now, depending on your sales cycle, you might not see the rewards for 90 days. You might not see see it for 6 months. Right. You might see it just, you know, for 30 days, depending on how long that cycle is. But certainly figuring out your formula, vitally important, and it has been for me.
So I know for me, Ken, you're telling me this story and reading my mail because I'm really good at prospecting avoidance. I do this radio show as a means of satisfying my brain that this is prospecting. I know it's not. I really need to pick up the phone. I look at my divine makeup, and I have everything required to be great at prospecting. I just don't do it. So how did you get past that? I don't know. For me, it's almost a level of entitlement that says, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years. I can live off referrals.
Yeah, and your prospecting, for me, my prospecting is a lot of referrals, but you still have to take the time to dig into who they know and then ask them and, you know, follow up if they don't reply, or there's just a lot of, you know, activities behind it. And my motivation initially back in January was when I told my wife, if I have to work 80 or 90 hours, I'm going to do what it takes and then we'll reevaluate. Well, I'm not somebody that likes to work 80 or 90 hours a week. So I think I had an extremely high level of motivation to try to get that level of behaviors done. And that first month, I hit the goal right on the number. And it's like, as soon as I hit that number, I don't think I did another behavior the rest of the month.
It wasn't recreational prospecting.
Yes. So forcing myself to block that time off. And, you know, when we suggest this to others, a lot of people say, yeah, that's a good idea. I'm going to go block 4 hours. Well, with today's technology, there's no way we can focus for 4 hours, because prospecting to me is I'm not allowed to look at my phone. I'm not allowed to answer a text. I'm not allowed to answer an inbound call. So to be able to do that and focus, the email program gets closed and you are doing what you're supposed to be doing for 15 to 30 minute intervals, as high a level as you can, and then you take a break. So that's really how I was able to hit those numbers.
I think that kind of cadence is vital to be successful. If you block out too much time, it's a death march.
Yep.
What are some of the head trash you had to get rid of, if any?
Well, there's a lot, as we all have. Some of us feel that cold calls don't work anymore. Some of us feel that I'm imposing on people if I ask for referrals. It's amazing how many people you could talk to and how many salespeople out there, if you ask them how many times a month do they ask for a referral, they don't have any metric associated with that because they have such head trash about reaching out to people. And I did too. At some point, you feel like you're imposing on people.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You really had to get past that, though, because I didn't want to have to cold call. I'd rather ask for referrals because the leads are much warmer, of course. So I had to get over that feeling of imposing. And you start to say to yourself things like, the only people that I'm hurting by not asking for this referral and not getting in front of this prospect is them, because they don't get exposure to what we do and how we help.
Great
people.
Point. I had as a guest earlier this year, Jeff Schneider. He was talking about prospecting, and he said, when you think of a prospector, you think of a 49er with a gold pan sifting through dirt trying to find gold. Prospecting today, he defines prospecting as interrupting someone else's day. And when you think of it as that, prospecting is interrupting someone else's day. It becomes, for me, much easier to do it because that really is the mission. It deals with the head trash. Am I interrupting? Yes. Why am I interrupting? Because they have an issue that only I can resolve. And without my intervention in their life, they're going to settle for less than they should. And so that creates this mindset. I look at it as, are you a missionary or a mercenary? A mercenary does prospecting to gain money. A missionary does it to really transform a business or personal lives by delivering on your business's promises to help the clients you serve have a better life. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. In fact, we'll ask this of our clients all the time, and you have to have a belief system. If I asked a client, I would say, who gets the better end of the deal when you sell them something, them or you?
Yeah,
and
right?
Sometimes they don't understand what I mean, and then I clarify and say, well, have you ever walked out of a selling appointment where you closed a piece of business and you felt like you sold them something for way more than it was worth and that you took advantage of them? And nobody says that.
No.
And so when you realize that and you take that mindset behind it, you realize that you are giving them the benefit. They are getting the greater benefit by working with you. Now, to the interruption point, I'll say this. I would say that the bulk of my prospecting is done through email as opposed to cold calls. In today's, there was a study done by the University of Michigan, I believe, College of Business in 2008 that said it took 3.7 attempts to cold cold call a prospect before they would actually pick the phone up, even if they pick the phone up and tell you they're not interested. In 2016, they redid the study, and it said it takes now 8 attempts to reach the same prospect because of all of the other ways that we communicate in today's business world. Mm. So by emailing folks, is it foolproof? Absolutely not. But if it's a personal email and there might be a referral attached, the chances of them replying are pretty high, and they can do it at their own time frame when I'm not in the middle of their day. So that's helped me with my head trash, right. And it seemed to be fairly effective.
Right. Well, good. Good for you, Ken. My guest today is Ken Guest. Ken, give your contact information in case somebody would like to reach out and have a conversation with you.
Sure. Email is ken.guest, G-U-E-S-T, at sandler.com, and telephone number is 330-421-7347.
Thank you so much, listeners, for inviting us into your world. I'm Jim Stevens, and my call is to wake up people from the slumber of mediocrity. If they're trapped in a comfort zone and frustrated because they're living with just good enough, ready to accept chaos and volatility in daily business and customer relationships, or prone to learn the hard way through trial and error, hoping that eventually they'll get it figured out. If you're ready to give up the insanity of repetition, call me at 208-429-9275. That's 208-429-9275. Have a great weekend, and remember, if you measure it, you'll manage it.